Today's Cloudcast is sponsored by Datadog, a modern, full-stack monitoring platform for cloud infrastructure, applications, and log metrics all in one place. Use Datadog's customizable dashboards to monitor, correlate, visualize, and alert on data from devices and cloud backends to have full visibility into performance. Datadog breaks down the silos within an organization's teams and removes blind spots that could cause potential downtime. With over 350 integrations, Datadog makes it easy for teams to collaborate together and monitor every layer of their stack within a single platform. So try Datadog for yourself with a free 14-day trial, and you'll receive a complimentary t-shirt. Just go to datadog.com/cloudcast. That's datadog.com/cloudcast.
Cloudcast Media presents from the Massive Studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome back to the Cloudcast. We're coming to you live from the massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. Just Aaron this week. Wanted to really just dive right into the cloud news of the week this week. We have a couple items of note, a couple acquisitions, a sell-off, and also a bit of a funding round as well. So let's dive right into the first one. Amazon has acquired DataRow. DataRow is a startup that was really created around Amazon Redshift and how to better support the Amazon Redshift ecosystem. Kind of a clientless approach to it and allows you to just better manage the operations. Pretty fascinating tool when you go to look into it. And of course, Amazon looking to just bolster some of those areas that need a little bit of help here and there. Secondly, moving on, it's something we actually alluded to on Cloud News of the Week earlier this year, and that is Dell selling off RSA, in this instance, to a private equity firm for a little over $2 billion. I don't think this comes really as a surprise to many people in our industry. Ever since Dell did the large acquisition of the pretty massive portfolio and one of the largest deals in history, well, there's going to be some overlap. There's going to be some pieces that just don't fit into the future, as well as some interest payments that need to be made. So RSA, I think, was a logical sell-off. And in addition to that, just a trend we're seeing here at the podcast, but I think in the industry as well, and that is just a general slowing of security investments in our industry as well. Moving on to the next one. Google has gone after another cloud migration company, Cornerstone. And so this goes along with CloudSimple and some of the other acquisitions they've done here recently. So what exactly is Cornerstone? I personally wasn't familiar with it. It is actually mainframe to cloud, which at first I was a bit of a head scratcher, but when you really dig into it, there's absolutely a market there. And Google, I think, is one of their ways and part of this larger strategy that is starting to come about of how do you get more data into the cloud platform? How can you get some of those workloads and have everyone think of Google as the migration path and not Azure or AWS? And lastly, compliance. Data compliance certainly has been an area where I've been focusing on the last couple of years, in my various day jobs. But it's also been getting a lot of venture capital money as well. And so a startup, OneTrust, has raised $210 million at a $2.7 billion valuation. And you can think of OneTrust as a compliance helper, compliance automation. You know, as GDPR comes into play and as the California privacy laws comes into play as well, really good to see some continued investment in this space as well. And certainly an area I will continue to watch. And this idea of data compliance and what it's going to do to our future going forward is something certainly worth watching as well. And so with that, we're going to wrap up Cloud News of the Week.
Today's show is brought to you by MongoDB. When you need to focus on building applications, do you want to get bogged down by your database? Definitely not. MongoDB is an intuitive, flexible document database that lets you get to building. MongoDB's document model is a natural way to represent data so you can focus on what matters. And MongoDB Atlas is the best way to use MongoDB. It's a global cloud database service that gives you all the developer productivity of MongoDB, plus the added simplicity of a fully managed database service. You can get started for free with MongoDB Atlas at mongodb.com/atlas. That's mongodb.com/atlas.
And we're back. I'd like to welcome to the show Chris Riley. Chris is DevOps advocate over at Splunk. Chris, why don't you go ahead and start by telling everyone a little bit about yourself? We met at AWS reInvent a couple months ago, but you've been active in this kind of DevOps space for quite some time. Why don't you tell everyone about yourself?
Yeah. And so active, in fact, that I remember the days of when I was having the arguments of DevOps not being a thing. I think specifically I argued that isn't DevOps just application lifecycle management, ALM and ARA. But I quickly jumped on the bandwagon and now a DevOps champion. Prior to that, I started my career in Colorado. I was in the IT ops, desktop support, managed services realm. And went and chased the Silicon Valley dream. I got my degree in computer science to become a developer. And I did that for a while, some really cool technology, very monolithic as you can get applications, but quickly found out that I'm not a good software developer. And I can prototype, but when it comes to the details and getting something production worthy, not my forte, nor something that I particularly enjoyed. I was all about building functionality and walking away and hoping that it worked. So
as somebody who has a computer science degree and I don't think has written any code since I've graduated, amen.
And I think that's part of the challenge is a computer science. It's a lot of universities, it tends to be overly theoretical. So I went from there. I didn't want to lose touch with that world because, you know, how applications are built and released has always been really interesting and passion of mine. And so I moved into what was evangelist role where, you know, internally at the company I worked for, my job is to represent the practitioner, be at trade shows and interact with them and so forth. And then externally, have those conversations and really understand the real world of what's going on, you know, not just from the vendor perspective, what's going on and how people are building and deploying applications. And so that's what I've been doing, focused very heavily on DevOps, just because that's the area that I enjoy the most.
So, Chris, about a year ago, we had a peer of yours and good friend of the show, Josh Atwell, on to talk about the state of DevOps in 2019. While we, you know, probably won't call this the state of DevOps 2020, what are your thoughts on changes over the last 12 months and a little bit about where we're headed in 2020?
So Josh being my boss, I would love to say that I could go back and just say that everything he mentioned was wrong.
First of all, I'm sorry that he's your boss, but go ahead.
But I think that DevOps, we really are kind of in this but this weird identity crisis where you have vendors who are working on creating new categories or extensions of the DevOps category to have something new to talk about, but it boils down to DevOps. And then you have companies who are, like I said before, no longer having the argument of, you know, is DevOps a thing? Should we do the DevOps and so forth? But really trying to solve real world problems. And I think that is great. I'm okay with DevOps being boring. I'm totally fine having something where we're no longer trying to convince people to embrace a new, you know, ideology, basically.
Well, and I've always had the theory boring means that it's potentially making money now.
Right. And we're getting real about it. And when you start to get real about it, you run into a lot of interesting problems that, you know, a presentation on culture is not going to answer for you. Companies still are seeking this DevOps checklist, you know, go through the 10 items. And once you're done, you've got the certificate and you now are DevOps. And ironically, the DevOps principles, not the practice, but the DevOps principles are such that there is no end. There is no I'm done and you walk away. It also has to be a framework. And that's where the culture piece kind of comes in. And again, people want kind of a systematic way of implementing culture in your organization. But the reason that's not possible is because every organization already has a culture. That's, you know, you can hate the word culture all you want and think that it means hoodies. But in reality, if you say you don't have a culture, that is your culture. So you have a starting point, and everybody's starting point is different, and you have to work from that. And for some people, if they don't have enough influence on that, then they need to leave. For example, if they are in a culture, so we talked about blameless, that was brought up. If you are in an organization in a culture that does seek to find somebody to blame and punish for when things go wrong, then maybe that's probably a place you shouldn't work anymore. I mean, that's always an option, but I think people need to understand leaving is an option. So as organizations figure this out, they get really serious about it. And I think that, you know, embracing that sort of, what I like to say is that let your engineers come to work and just be their best selves versus having baggage at the door of all the stuff that they are afraid or, you know, need to do to navigate the organization. As soon as you do that, then things are free flowing. It creates some new challenges, but in general, if people are not walking in the door with a chip on their shoulder and can focus on their job, then that is an efficiency thing. That is a business problem. It's not a fluffy kumbaya problem. It is an actual business problem. On the technology front, again, what you see a lot of organizations doing is they get to increased application release velocity quickly. So they start to build in some release automation, some tests. They, you know, segment their teams a little bit better, whatever it is, they start releasing functionality faster, but they seldom think about what that faster is going to mean in terms of support, testing, and production. And so you see a lot of organizations get caught off guard where their initial thought, and especially when it's led by development, that is, oh, we just have to go fast and we're doing great. But fast creates some challenges, and modern application architectures create some challenges. So there is a lot of maturity that organizations need to do in terms of monitoring and supporting their applications and addressing issues as well. And also instrumenting and making sure that their pipeline can keep up with that velocity. So you see a lot of organizations embracing that. You see a lot of vendors coming out with terminology and technology around that to support it. So I think that that's a big thing. In 2020, you know, I thought 2018 was going to be the year of serverless. Now I'm going to say 2020 is going to be the year of serverless. I don't know if that's true or not, but there's a lot of interesting things happening at the edge. Edge computing, and certainly in the world of serverless, but still a lot to be done just to get people up to pace with modern development practices.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good point, Chris. And I'll add another one for you. One item in particular that has drawn my attention here lately with your discussions in particular is this concept of incident response, kind of this intersection of that with machine learning. Can you tell everyone a little bit about that and why you believe it's going to be valuable going forward?
Yeah, so I'm going to have a little intro just on the concept of AI ops and incident or ML.
Because this isn't again, just chat ops at another level.
No, it's not. You know, and to begin with, like when we actually say words like AI ops and ML, it's not, it's from the vendors, it's fairy dust, like throw some fairy dust in their face and, you know, expect them to get excited. But there is tactics behind this, and understanding where those tactics are going and why they're there is important. So first, why they're there. Again, application architectures are not getting easier. They're getting more complex. And then we have this idea of shift left, which is saying, okay, developers are going to support what they built, and they're going to take on more responsibilities and be more accountable for things in the, you know, more downstream application lifecycle and production stuff. So as you do that, no organization is going to, you know, embrace DevOps and be like, all right, so now we need to hire a whole bunch of more developers because we did the shift left thing, or you know, let's increase our developers' workload because, you know, they don't have enough work already. So what has to happen is you have to find ways to reduce the developers' amount of effort and increase their efficiency as they receive, you know, things like now they're on call for their code. So that's really where machine learning and AI technologies and AI ops technologies come in, is to augment and support. It's not to replace. It's not sentient beings that start taking over operations. It's to support and help the developers and DevOps engineers and SREs, et cetera. Now, particularly in incident response, today where we see ML very heavily is the every organization knows that when something breaks, there's basically two strategies. There's the spray and pray strategy, where you blast out a phone number, you expect everybody to get on a war bridge, and you hope that somebody that joins is actually the person who can solve the problem. Or you have the complete opposite of that, where you always call that one person in the organization who knows how to fix everything. So instead, you know, a strong incident response strategy and tool, you should be able to figure out, have recommendations of who you can bring into the firefight with you based on previous incidents and previous work that they've done. And so it really helps you take an the context of an incident and align it to the subject matter expert. And that's super powerful. Even if that subject matter expert is not on an on-call rotation right now, it helps you get to the right person quickly instead of guessing or looking at a spreadsheet or hoping that somebody on the conference bridge is the right person. So that's one way. Another way into the continuous improvement story, where you want to look historically over a long period of time of incidents, and when a new one comes in, see how they correlate. So how do you relate a new incident that you just got to previous similar versions of that incident? And so that, again, is machine learning to identify, you know, those patterns and so forth. Long term, you can foresee how this would run into like integration of incident response to playbooks and auto remediation and self-healing and things of that sort. And I think that that's the next phase. Like, that's where it's going. But the bottom line is, as everybody takes on more complex applications, greater workloads, greater application velocity, ML, the technologies around that are meant to not increase the human effort as a result of embracing those.
Yeah. That's so it's not the singularity for incident
right,
response.
Exactly.
So, but
yeah, well, go ahead. If we had true AI ops, this is what I tell people. If we had true AI ops, like if we were all the way AI ops, then we wouldn't even have developers. So it's not even, that just reminded me, I watched I Am Mother on the flight home.
Was it good? Sorry, we're gonna divert real quick.
It's a great movie, but it made me think of that. It would be like that for DevOps.
It's in my
mother
gear.
For DevOps, but we wouldn't even have developers. So AI ops and historically all technology like sunglasses and joints and all of that stuff have been meant to augment the human to do their job better. And that's what it is.
Yeah. And it feels in a way like we're a bit of a, it's a bit of a transition into kind of the next evolution of this model, right? We first had this kind of separate dev and ops, no one talked, and then we put them all together and DevOps was formed. And then we had every device and every app start spitting out logs and alerts. And next thing you know, we were drowning in data and we started to have a signal to noise problem. And, the complexity of the systems seems to have grown exponentially, or the amount of data out of these systems has grown exponentially. And so if nothing else, this is maybe a way to better filter signal from noise. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yeah. I think what's interesting is people go, when they think about their data, they think about it in two extremes. They think about collection, like, okay, let's get all the data. And then they think about dashboard, essentially. And now let's visualize the data. What they don't connect is what's the most important part, which is the intelligence behind the data that you have. You can collect any amount of data you want. Are you correlating it correctly? You know, does that data relate to properly to how you're running the application? Like we talk about, you know, the red metrics from Microsoft, but even there's controversies around what are the exact right metrics that you should have to support your application. And it turns out it's not the same for everybody. It's not a one size fits all. The types, so, and this is a good example, the types of metrics you can collect are pretty much the same for everybody. So you can collect them and store them. What you monitor, what metrics you look at, and in what order and in what relationship is different. There's cohorts of organizations doing it similar ways, but they're all different as well. And so organizations need to think about, before they collect telemetry data from any of their systems and pipeline, think about how they're going to utilize it first. They actually should go backwards into what do we want to use the data for, to let's make sure we have the data to support it. So the wealth of information is tremendous. And, you know, I'm of the belief that you should get as much of it as you possibly can. I mean, storage, the price of storage is always going down, you know, and the cost of storing this data and visualizing it is not tremendous. It's really deciding how you're going to maximize it, which is a strategy and an organization problem, not a tool problem.
So Chris, I'll kind of take it one step further then. You recently did a blog post over on the VictorOps blog, and there, we'll put a link to it in the show notes, thinking about SRE and the definition of SRE maybe a little differently. And again, kind of a transition and evolution of some of our models in this industry. You propose more and more it should, the S should stand for service reliability engineer versus the more traditional site reliability engineer. So especially as we move into a more subscription-based world, we're starting to bring in some of these other, you know, technologies. Can you explain to everyone a little bit about what you meant by that and what your thoughts are there?
Yeah, well, from my perspective, it's a little bit of right-sizing on our terminology, because if you look at how we refer to everything else in the application development space, it's as a service, services.
Right.
You know, you are building services, you're deploying services. We talk about services constantly. And this idea that a site to me is very static. It's a static point in time and space. And the thing with that is that what's happening is versions, we use application versions, but more from a source kind of control perspective. But microservices, if you're in a microservices environment, and everything rolls up to a broader application. And so even this idea of like a static version of the application is not really there. Everything's kind of fluid. So again, the reason I like service reliability is because it's customer centric. So if you think about everything as being customer obsessed first, like I said before about data, first, what are you going to do with it? How does it impact your customer? Back to the technology that you're going to use it, where most organizations go the other way. You're providing a service to your customer, which means that it's not just like, for example, latency is the new downtime. You can't, latent applications are as bad as down applications. So these are all things that your customers care about. And when you think about what you're really supporting, you're supporting their journey, which is a service. You're providing them a service. They're not buying a box that they're installing anymore. And so I just feel like it's kind of a better alignment of the definition of what SREs actually are doing. And the best SRE strategies that I've seen have been customer obsessed. And so it really, again, is that idea that we are providing a service and everything we do around our pipeline is going to map to that value versus let's look at, you know, site uptime. Let's look at CPU. Let's look at, you know, these types of metrics.
Yeah, that's such a good point. The latency point in particular, you know, like just from a personal standpoint, yeah, it's, you know, you get to the point as soon as you have to wait on something. And I guess, you know, it's our increasingly short attention spans and increasingly yeah. high yeah. expectations of all
our,
of these
our hostile users. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Well, I mean, isn't it amazing? Like, I think this is true even for non-technical people. Like my parents and my wife, who don't come from a technical background, when they add a new application to their iPhone, they get a pulse on whether that application is good or not. And strangely enough, that pulse definitely translates to the efficiency and effectiveness of the dev team behind it. There's no doubt. I mean, I can point out several consumer-based applications out there that are so obviously bad, and it's clear that it's their app dev team that is not performing as it should be.
Yeah. Well, and so actually let's take that one step further, right? So when I think of incident response as a discipline, I think of production environments, right? But as part of VictorOps, I'm sure you've seen a lot of use cases and have solved some pretty unique customer problems and latency problems and service availability problems. And so how can these concepts and ideas be applied outside of production, say for exactly what we just talked about, application testing or quality control before things even hit production, right? Is this a valid way to think about that?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And so there's three very interesting categories where the technology fits seamlessly. It's not, you're not making it bend and contorting it in some strange way to make it work, but incident response definitely fits in other areas that are both pre-production and back into planning, post-production, completing the loop. I've never, you know, you see the DevOps diagrams and it's always, you know, some sort of infinite feedback loop, right? Continuous. But most organizations consider the end of DevOps still to be prod, or maybe the support of the application in prod. So that's the end. Maybe there's an incident and you do a postmortem, and maybe you take that postmortem and you create a runbook, or you work on some continuous improvement stuff. But by and large, most organizations are completing that loop. So that's the first place, is using incident response to complete the loop, so that you can actually take what's happened contextually, the audit trail of everything that has happened related to an incident, and learn from it in order to, you know, ideally create a runbook so that the next time that incident happens, somebody just has a runbook they can run, or documentation, you know, heaven forbid, but good documentation means a lot, or even going back to product, because you can understand things that maybe it's not a P1, because a lot of times we think about incidents as being critical, you know, outages. It may be less critical events, but still very educational to product teams and planning. So that's one area. The second area, like you said, is in quality. So if you've ever been a quality assurance or quality engineer, and you've run a lot of Selenium tests, you know that Selenium generally is pretty damn slow. And your breadth of testing is based partly on your ability to run tests quickly. So you have a window of when you can run your tests. And within that window, you have to shove as much tests in there as you possibly can. So what happens when you run a test suite on a Thursday afternoon? This is just a hypothetical example. So you run a test suite on a Thursday afternoon so that on Friday, you can make sure that you all the bugs are addressed for a deployment next week, for example. Well, if a Selenium test run fails, and it's not related to the test failing, it's actually the test run, the suite failing, and it doesn't complete the entire suite, you have to restart. Which means that if that happens on a Thursday and you only find out Friday morning when you wake up, then you can only restart it on a Friday, which means it could then break over the weekend, provided you fix the problem. You're going to delay a release. And so releasing applications faster is great, but if you don't have good test coverage, then you're just releasing broken applications faster. So that's where embedding incident response into your CI process, where you run your tests. It could be Selenium testing, unit testing, integration testing, et cetera. You know, whatever you have, load testing, and being able to get alerted when things break, either on an infrastructure end or the test run in, is super powerful. So that same value that you get in production, you can get at the production side of testing, essentially. You also now can run tests in prod, because you can, if you embed incident response, you can start to do a subset of your test suite and load testing in prod by having good incident response, because it gives you the confidence to do that without being terrified that you're just going to destroy everything as a result. And continuous testing is also a big movement. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is in the AppSec world, using incident response. So tons of organizations, nearly all development organizations, are embracing some sort of open source. To embrace open source responsibly, you should have, as a part of your testing and maybe even in production, vulnerability scanning, regular scanning of your open source libraries to make sure there isn't a recent CV for it. So you could do this for deployment just fine and know. But what happens if you deploy an application and the vulnerability is only realized after it's in production, and maybe it's a service that's not touched all that much? Another place where incident response can come in is that you're doing the scanning in production and you get alerted when a new vulnerability is detected, which allows you to quickly address it, which allows you to potentially mitigate some very, very serious issues down the road as it relates to AppSec.
Yeah, that's such good insight. So we're about out of time. And actually, I apologize, we didn't mention this in the intro. You do a podcast as well. So why don't we close this out by, you know, Chris, tell everyone a little bit, you know, where can they find you? Where are some of the places you're active? Of course, there's devops.com. There's your podcast. Tell everyone, you know, where they can go learn more.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Aaron, for having me on. It's fun. And this is my favorite part of my job, doing stuff like this, just blabbing. So you can find me, I blog in several places, most specifically the VictorOps blog, devops.com, Container Journal, SweetCode. I'm a regular speaker at DevOps events. And on SweetCode as well, you'll see the podcast Developers Eating the World, which is a very kind of SRE developer-focused podcast. And of course, there is Twitter. My handle is at HoardingInfo. Last week or 2 weeks ago, I forget, I did a session at DevWeek. And one of my points in my session as it related to helping people navigate this market, I put adopt an advocate. There's a lot of advocates out there. I'm one. Splunk has several others as well. And I actually really encourage people in the industry, because you learn the most from your peers. You learn the most from testing software. But advocates, you know, the best advocates will always represent, you know, the reality of bringing technology to the world. And I encourage everybody to connect with, you know, whether it's me, hopefully it's me, engage with me, but find a few advocates in the industry, because they are uniquely connected not only to their company, but they're uniquely connected to the entire industry. So they have a lot of knowledge about a lot of technologies out there, and they're just a good resource for information. So hopefully I get a chance to engage with some of the listeners.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, thank you so much for your time. On behalf of Brian, who wasn't able to make it this week, thank you everyone for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.